You are listening to an ADIS Journal podcast.
Hi, everyone. My name is Anjay Rastogi. I'm a nephrologist and a pharmacologist based out of Los Angeles with a special interest in rare diseases, including IgA nephropathy, or IgAN. The topic of the podcast today is the role of the alternative complement pathway in IgA nephropathy for APPs, advanced practice providers. This podcast article is being hosted in Advances in Therapy and is being supported by Novartis Pharmaceutical Corporation. With that, I would like to welcome and introduce my two esteemed APPs, Yasin Kadi, who's a physician assistant, and Yelena Magai, who is a nurse practitioner. Welcome, both of you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Yelena Magai, and I'm a nurse practitioner in Lafayette, Louisiana. I work with the Ochsner Health System. I've been working in nephrology for about the past 10 years, and I split my time between our chronic kidney disease clinic and the inpatient nephrology service. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to join Dr. Rastogi and Yasin as we talk about IgA nephropathy.
Hi, my name is Yasin Kadi. I'm a physician assistant. I'm located in Orange County, California. I've been practicing for almost 6 years, and I'm lucky to practice at a multi-specialty clinic in endocrinology, nephrology, and lipidology. I do both inpatient and outpatient practice. This multi-specialty work that I do allows me to take in more comprehensive management in IgAN.
Thank you so much for joining us. So with that, the objectives of today's podcast are to summarize the epidemiology, pathogenesis, pathology, and clinical features of IgAN, to discuss the importance of the alternative pathway in IgAN, and finally to review the clinical implications of alternative pathway overactivation in IgAN. Now, let's talk about its epidemiology. It's the most common primary GN, glomerulonephritis worldwide, caused by deposition of immune complexes containing galactose-deficient IgA1 in the kidney, and more specifically in the mesangium of the kidney. As of today, the only way we can diagnose IgA nephropathy is via kidney biopsy. The estimated global incidence is about 2.5 cases per 100,000 people, and it contributes to the global burden of CKD, or chronic kidney disease, with up to 50% of patients progressing to kidney failure within 10 to 20 years. Now I'll hand over to Yasin.
Now that Dr. Rastogi has given our nice introduction regarding IgAN, I want to focus on how this disease presents in real clinical practice. One of the biggest challenges with IgAN is that the presentation is quite variable. Some patients may only have asymptomatic microscopic hematuria, sometimes with low-grade proteinuria found incidentally. Others present later with more established chronic kidney disease. And at the severe end of the spectrum, some can present with rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis. So it's really not a one-pattern disease, and it has broad clinical range. In adults, the most common presentation is asymptomatic hematuria with varying degrees of proteinuria, whereas in children and younger patients, gross hematuria is often found at the time of an upper respiratory infection or gastrointestinal infection. And this syntheringitic pattern is important because it hints at the mucosal immune dysregulation that sits upstream in terms of the disease pathophysiology. Another key point is that hematuria and proteinuria are not specific to IgAN. They can be seen in many kidney pathology. So while it may raise suspicion, it does not establish diagnosis. As Dr. Rastogi mentioned, biopsy is the gold standard for diagnosis and risk assessment.
Great. So Yasin, I just wanted to highlight that you said IgA nephropathy tends to be asymptomatic or very subtle in majority of patients. So I think that's something important to keep in mind. So now I would like to invite Yelena to speak on the clinical features of IgA nephropathy.
Thank you, Dr. Rastogi. As Dr. Rastogi and Yasin already mentioned, presentation of IgA nephropathy can be a little bit vague. So in order to confirm the diagnosis of IgA nephropathy, we do need to have a kidney biopsy performed. On biopsy, we're specifically looking for predominant or codominant IgA deposits in the glomeruli, which are identified using immunofluorescence staining. These changes are illustrated in Figure 1. In adults, current guidelines recommend a kidney biopsy in patients with proteinuria of about 0.5 gram per day. this is a new change per KDIGO 2025 guidelines. In a situation where IgA nephropathy is a possible diagnosis and where there are no contraindications to the procedure. In children, the threshold is different. Guidelines recommend considering IgA nephropathy when hematuria is accompanied by persistent proteinuria, a protein to creatinine ratio is 0.2 milligrams per milligram or 20 milligrams per millimole or higher that lasts for about 2 to 3 weeks, as long as serum C3 levels are normal and there's no evidence of a lower urinary tract cause or a systemic disease. In those cases, a biopsy should be used to confirm the diagnosis. Another important role of kidney biopsy is that it provides histologic information that also helps us guide prognosis. The biopsy findings can be scored using the Oxford MEST-C classification, which feeds into the International IgA Nephropathy Prediction Tool. Those tools help clinicians estimate disease progression risk and guide management decisions. Despite how important kidney biopsy is for diagnosis and for risk assessment, it may still be underutilized in clinical practice. And there are several reasons for this. Some providers may have limited training or familiarity with biopsy indications or interpretation. Others may be concerned about procedural risks or question whether the biopsy results will meaningfully change management. And in some cases, clinicians may simply feel less comfortable discussing the risks and benefits of a kidney biopsy with patients, and that can make decision process even more challenging.
Thank you, Irina. Now, a question to both of you. The KDIGO guidelines, as you've mentioned, has changed the threshold for biopsying. We normally biopsied for about 1 gram. So my question to both of you would be, with the new guidelines that came out in September of last year, have your practices changed?
Absolutely. Especially if my pre-test probability is high for any glomerular disease, especially for IgA nephropathy, I am much more likely to send the patient for biopsy, provided there are no contraindication, especially since I have backing from the guidelines now.
Wonderful. And Yassim, how about you?
Down here in Orange County, we've always been a bit more aggressive in terms of screening early and trying to diagnose earlier. The demographic in Orange County has both Caucasian and Asian individuals, the latter of which, unfortunately, due to socioeconomic or social determinants of health, often have limited access to care. And possibly those patients, clinicians are maybe less inclined to biopsy. When we get those kind of referrals, we are quite aggressive. Yes.
Thank you, Asin. And you bring up another barrier that would be socioeconomic. I think these are very important things. Now, Yassine, we'll continue with pathogenesis.
It's best understood through what's commonly known as the multi-hit model. And the first hit is increased production of galactose-deficient IgA1. And this is an abnormally glycosylated form of IgA1. And patients with IgAN often have elevated circulating levels of it. More importantly, this abnormality appears to be heritable, partly at least. And some unaffected family members can also have elevated levels, which tells us that this first hit is important, but not sufficient enough to produce a full clinical presentation of the disease. Second hit, formation of autoantibodies directed against those abnormal glycans. The third hit is formulation of circulating immune complexes. These complexes contain galactose-deficient IgA1, anti-glycan autoantibodies, and sometimes C3. The fourth hit is mesangial deposition of these complexes, which leads to the downstream activation of inflammatory and proliferative signaling pathways, which include the alternative and lectin complement pathways, which lead to damage and eventually fibrosis. IgAN is not just a disease of IgA deposition. It's a multifactorial, multi-step autoimmune process that involves IgA1 production, autoantibody formation, mesangial injury, complement activation, and of course, fibrosis.
Great, Yassine. And I just want to highlight the alternative complement pathway, and we'll be doing a much deeper dive later. So Yassine, you'll be continuing with the risk factors for disease progression.
For me, the most important question is not just who has IgAN, but who's most likely to progress. The important modifiable factors are proteinuria and hypertension. Persistent proteinuria is the strongest marker of ongoing glomerular injury. Reducing proteinuria is associated with better outcomes. blood pressure control is equally foundational. Other contributors include decreased kidney function or lower EGFR at presentation, use of tobacco, and obesity. So progression is not just driven by one's immunology, it's also shaped by hemodynamic and, what is a hot topic today, metabolic stress layered on top of the immune pathology. The non-modifiable factors are older age at diagnosis, male sex, ethnicity is also a factor. The highest incidence of IgAN is reported in Asia, followed by Europe, and lowest in Africa. Asian patients have been found to have poor renal outcomes compared to their Caucasian counterparts. In a study in the U.S., those with a known race, the majority of patients with IgAN were Caucasian, 8% were African American, and a similar number were Asian. So all ethnic backgrounds are at risk.
Great. Thank you so much, Yasin. So the 2025 KDIGO guidelines set a goal for proteinuria. How has that impacted your practice as well? And what is the goal?
The goal reduction for proteinuria management in IgA nephropathy is less than 0.5 grams per day, and if possible, even below 0.3 grams per day. And the reason for that is because it's a prognostic marker and also marker of disease activity. We know that lower degree of proteinuria is associated with better long-term prognosis.
Great. And I'm sure you've seen your practice has changed the same way too.
That's correct.
All right. So now we'll move into the treatment and management of IgA nephropathy based on the most current guidelines from KDIGO. So, Elena?
Thank you, Dr. Astogi. One of the most important things to understand about IgA nephropathy is that there's currently no cure. Because of that, the main goal of therapy is really focused on slowing disease progression and preventing kidney failure. According to the KDIGO 2025 guidelines, one of the key treatment targets is reducing proteinuria. As we have mentioned earlier, we want to bring proteinuria down to less than 0.5 grams per day, and if possible, even below 0.3 grams a day, because lower levels of proteinuria are associated with much better prognosis over time. Another important point is that the treatment landscape for IgA nephropathy is evolving very quickly. As in new clinical trials and new therapies become available, our approach to management continues to change. Figure 3 outlines a treatment algorithm that combines recommendations from the KDIGO 2025 guidelines along with the new FDA-approved therapies that have become available since the guideline cutoff. Any patient that is at risk for disease progression per risk stratification can begin simultaneous IgA nephropathy-specific intervention along with the foundational interventions. Foundational interventions include optimizing blood pressure and cardiorenal risk, along with reducing glomerular hyperfiltration and proteinuria by introducing lifestyle or dietary modifications, starting the patient on RAS blockers like ACE and ARB therapies, SGLT2 inhibitors, or endothelin antagonists. IgA-specific interventions include reducing formation of immune complexes containing galactose-deficient IgA1, and reducing immune complex and complement-mediated kidney injury and inflammation. Those treatments include delayed-release budesonide, systemic glucocorticoids, complement inhibitors, and APRIL-targeting agents. In specific populations, we can also utilize mycophenolate, hydrochloroquine, tonsillectomy, MRA, and clinical trial enrollment. One challenge that we still face in IgA nephropathy is that we don't yet have validated biomarkers that can help us match specific patients with specific treatments. As more therapies become available, this becomes increasingly important. So identifying reliable biomarkers to guide treatment decisions is really considered a major priority for future research in IgA nephropathy.
Yelena, thank you so much for this presentation on the management. I want to point out the foundational intervention and the IgA nephropathy-specific intervention, that's basically the immune drivers of nephron loss, they both should be started simultaneously. And we need to separate those two big buckets. I think that was one of the highlights from these KDIGO guidelines. Now let's go over the complement system. The complement system plays a key role in both innate and adaptive immunity, as well as inflammatory responses. Our body has a complement system to fight injuries. It's when these system is overactivated or inappropriately activated, that's when we have problems. It's comprised of three pathways: the classical pathway, the lectin pathway and the alternative pathway. In IgA nephropathy, the deposition of immune complexes containing galactose-deficient IgA1 leads to overactivation of both the alternative and the lectin complement pathways, leading to glomerular injury and inflammation. However, the alternative pathway is of particular importance as it is responsible for up to 80% of complement activity. So let's go over this alternative pathway. C3 is common to all pathways, and it can undergo hydrolysis by a process that we call tickover. And this C3, which is hydrolyzed now, can bind or interact with factor B. And the factor B is broken down by factor D into BA and BB. So BA separates, but the BB stays attached to the factor C3 that's hydrolyzed, or even the C3B formed from other pathways. This C3B, BB is what we call the C3 convertase of the alternative pathway, an enzyme that converts C3 into C3A and C3B. They're also regulators that will make sure that there's no overactivation. There's a factor H, and there's also a factor HR, the factor H-related protein that actually works on the factor H. Now, as there's more C3B being formed, it attaches to the C3 convertase, and now we have C3B, BB, 3B. This is the C5 convertase, and this acts on complement 5, and it's broken down into C5A and C5B. C5B then starts the MAC, the membrane attack complex, that actually puts these pores on foreign microbes and destroys them. So this is the alternative complement pathway, and as I mentioned, in IgA nephropathy, it is overactive. Now, what is the evidence of overactivation of the alternative pathway in IgA nephropathy? I would break down this evidence into three big buckets: histological evidence, then genetic evidence, and then serum evidence. So let's go over the histological evidence. So mesangial co-deposition of C3 and IgA, which is in more than 90% of the kidney biopsies, correlates with disease severity and progression. Co-deposition of C3 and IgA can be seen with any type of complement activation, but here the feature is deposition of properdin. Properdin stabilizes the C3 convertase of the alternative pathway. Properdin is a unique activator of the alternative pathway and is found in 75 to 100% of patients. Now, factor H, it's a negative regulator of the alternative pathway and is found in 30 to 90% of IgAN cases. Finally, the glomerular deposition of factor H-related protein 5, a positive regulator of the alternative pathway, is associated with progressive disease. So this is what we find on biopsy, the histological evidence. What is the genetic evidence? Factor H-related gene deletions confer protection against IgA nephropathy development. And finally, the serum evidence. High IgA C3 ratio is associated with poor kidney survival in patients, and high serum levels of factor H-related protein 5 has been associated with more severe histological diagnosis. Now, what are the clinical implications of alternative pathway activation in IgA nephropathy? Yasin will throw more light on this topic.
I firmly believe that there's a gap between what we know mechanistically and what we actually do in practice. We have strong evidence that the alternative complement pathway plays a real role in disease progression. These immune complexes don't just sit in the mesangium. They activate complement, and that amplifies inflammation and furthers glomerular injury. But clinically, unfortunately, we're not measuring any of that. And there's no routine way to assess this pathway activity in our patients. We're not using it to guide care. Right now, we don't have any validated diagnostics in terms of urine or serum biomarkers for IgAN. That's where things need to evolve. Biomarkers that detect disease earlier help us understand which pathways are active and therefore would predict in some way which treatment would be best for this patient. This becomes especially relevant in terms of the evolving, exciting therapeutic landscape and how these emerging treatments are going to be fitting into real-world, real-time clinical decision-making.
Thank you, Yasin. We really do need more biomarkers, not just diagnostic, but also prognostic and also therapeutic. In the future, we'll be getting a lot of this information. a lot of these things are being incorporated in trials. Now, the landscape of IgA nephropathy is really evolving very rapidly, and the guidelines that came out last year in September, to some extent, might be a bit outdated already. It's a very rapidly evolving landscape, and we have a lot of drugs that have already gone through the FDA approval, either accelerated or full, and there are a lot of drugs that are in trials, so we'll be expecting a lot more. But let's go over the ones that are already approved. So let's start with the first one, Nefecon, which is a delayed-release formulation of the corticosteroid budesonide, and it targets B cells within the ileum to reduce galactose-deficient IgA1 production, which is the autoantigen in IgA nephropathy. The second drug is sibeprenlimab, a blocker of APRIL, which is proliferation-inducing ligand. APRIL is a cytokine that belongs to the TNF superfamily, and it mediates the antibody class switching in mature B cells and also plasma cell survival. Sibeprenlimab reduces the production of galactose-deficient IgA1 molecules. So these are immunosuppressive medications, but I would call them immune modulators and more targeted. Sparsentan is a dual endothelin type A and angiotensin 2 type 1 receptor antagonist, which targets hemodynamic, inflammatory, and fibrotic processes through simultaneous blockade of these receptors. Atrasentan is a selective endothelin type A receptor antagonist with hemodynamic, anti-inflammatory, and anti-fibrotic effects through reduction of intraglomerular pressure, mesangial activation, and podocyte and tubular injury. And the last one is iptacopan, the alternative complement pathway factor B inhibitor, which reduces overactivation of the alternative pathway and targets subsequent inflammatory processes. So these are five drugs that are currently approved by FDA. Now, we have mentioned the KDIGO practice guidelines that came out in September of last year several times. And I would strongly urge and recommend everybody who's listening to pull up these guidelines and have a look at them. They had a significant impact on our diagnostic criteria and also the therapeutic goals. But keep in mind, it does not include all recent drug approvals. The treatment algorithms will need frequent updates and also communication to the providers that updates have been done.
So building on that, once we consider, like Dr. Rastogi says, the dynamic expanding therapeutic landscape, I think the next question becomes, who are we actually treating and why? Because IgA nephropathy is not a uniform disease, like we discussed, it's heterogeneous. Identifying the subset of patients where complement and the alternative pathway that's driving the disease is very important. That's where hopefully biomarkers will come in. This could come from biopsy-based approach, which would come from validated complement staining patterns, or novel non-invasive approach, which is one, serologic biomarker, two, functional complement assays, which would allow you to assess this pathway in real time. Once we do that, we can move from the blunt tools to targeted therapy. And that's how you actually unlock the value of complement inhibition, in my opinion.
So the tool that we currently have is the kidney biopsy. But we cannot proceed with either a diagnosis or treatment if we're not utilizing the tools that we currently have. So the important point is that we need to encourage more appropriate use of kidney biopsy in clinical practice. There are several ways that we can help move in that direction. First, of course, is education. And we can achieve that through creating targeted initiatives that can help providers better understand when a kidney biopsy is indicated, how to interpret the histopathology, and how those findings can actually impact clinical decision-making. Second is to develop clear clinical protocols, especially for providers that are new to practice. If we have clear evidence-based biopsy protocols for suspected IgA nephropathy, it can help standardize our care. Those protocols can outline things like risk stratification, appropriate patient selection, and how biopsy results should be integrated into treatment. Of course, another component is multidisciplinary collaboration. When nephrologists, pathologists, and advanced practice providers work closely together, it can significantly improve confidence in both biopsy decision-making and interpretation of the results, which ultimately leads to better patient care. Finally, patient-centered communication is, of course, essential. Providers need to feel comfortable with having clear, balanced conversations with patients about the risks and benefits of kidney biopsy, as well as any alternatives. If we incorporate shared decision-making, this ensures that these choices align with each of the patient's values, preferences, and overall goals of care.
This is really very important. IgA nephropathy is a diagnosis that can only be made on a biopsy. We don't have the biomarkers, at least yet, that we can use to diagnose. So the role of the pathologist is very important, and the pathologist is a part of the team. Communication with the pathologist is very important. So let me ask you, Yelena, how often do you actually speak to your pathologist?
Every single time. Every time we have a preliminary result, the pathologist reaches out to the ordering provider, which is me, whenever I order a kidney biopsy. So that's very helpful with aligning the biopsy findings from the pathologist's point of view to the clinical presentation of the patient. Then we can discuss, order specific staining or further testing if needed. Those conversations have been very important.
And Yassine, how about you?
Unfortunately, the hospital system has a contract with another lab. And let's just say things are a bit more challenging to just even discuss. And so in an ideal world, yes, but real life limitations happen.
Right. Yeah. There might be challenges for us across the country. And I think the key thing is to keep on trying to communicate. I really appreciate our APPs, and two of the best ones that I know are here today with me. The role of APPs in nephrology is getting more and more important. And they will play a central role in IgA nephropathy, not just in diagnosis, but also management. And the collaboration is very, very important. So with that, I would like to invite first Yelena and then Yassine to provide some concluding remarks on today's presentation and what does it mean really to them as APP and also for the APP colleagues that are listening to this podcast.
All right. So as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a few key takeaways. First, IgA nephropathy remains the most common primary glomerulonephritis worldwide. Unfortunately, as we have said earlier, many patients will experience progressive disease, and a significant portion of them may develop kidney failure within just 10 to 20 years after diagnosis. Because the clinical presentation can be so variable, kidney biopsy still remains essential for making a definitive diagnosis and for helping us understand a patient's individual risk for progression. From a pathophysiology standpoint, the multi-hit model helps explain how the disease develops. Aberrant IgA production leads to the formation of immune complexes that deposit in the glomeruli, triggering inflammation and kidney injury. An important part of this process is overactivation of the alternative complement pathway, which can further amplify the damage that happens in the kidney. As we look ahead, several developments are likely to improve the way we care for the patients with IgA nephropathy. One major priority is to develop reliable, non-invasive biomarkers that can help us with earlier diagnosis and better disease monitoring. We also need to move towards earlier detection, more personalized risk prediction, and better tools to monitor complement activity. And that could help us guide treatment decisions more precisely. At the same time, new complement-targeted therapies are beginning to enter clinical practice. They offer treatment options that go beyond traditional supportive care and immunosuppression. Equally important is strengthening how we use the tools that we already have. That includes greater utilization of kidney biopsy, improved provider education, the development of clear clinical protocols, and strong collaboration between nephrologists, pathologists, and advanced care providers. Ultimately, by combining better diagnostics, targeted therapies, and biopsy-guided clinical decision-making, we can move beyond one-size-fits-all care and towards more personalized treatment strategies to improve outcomes and quality of life for every single patient that lives with IgA nephropathy.
Thanks, Yelena. On the whole team-based approach, Dr. Rastogi, thank you, because I never thought about it like that. The pathologist is a huge part of the team. Obviously, nephrologists lead the way. I believe that physician assistants and nurse practitioners can contribute. They can spend a little bit more time convincing the patient in a slow, controlled, empowered way to go ahead and go forward with just basic diagnostics, a 24-hour urine protein, a biopsy, which many of my patients I see do not have. And the patient's family is also very important. Moving towards the therapeutic landscape, like Yelena and Dr. Rastogi mentioned, the IgAN therapeutic landscape is constantly evolving. So there's a need for novel biomarkers to provide personalized treatment guidance. For example, we need to identify which patients would benefit from complement inhibition. It's not a one-person job. It's not a one-mechanism disease. And it's about aligning the right team, optimizing the right diagnostics, and delivering the most precise treatment algorithm for the patient. That's how we move forward.
Wonderful. And I think Yasin mentioned that, Yelena definitely implied that. It's not just about patient-centric care, it's about person-centric care. And at the end, as a pharmacologist, I will say the most expensive drug is the one that you never took. So if the patients don't take the medication, it won't work no matter how good the medication is. And I think that's where the education piece that was re-emphasized is very critical. We need to spend time with the patient. We need to tell them what's important. Going over even the biopsy results, whatever their level of understanding is, the outcomes that might happen if we don't intervene, all those things are important if we're going to really implement the guideline-directed medical therapy. So with that, we're going to conclude this podcast. I really hope you found this useful. We went over IgA nephropathy. We went over the role of the alternative complement pathway and also the clinical manifestations and how do we actually manage this overactivation. So with that, thank you very much for joining today.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Journal Podcasts with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements and copyright information, please visit the article page on the journal website. The link to the article page can be found in the podcast description.